It's definitely drawing on the experience I got there that has stood me in good stead. And first of all, just want to say it's great to be back on Radio Adelaide, and huge thanks to you and everyone at the station for fighting the good fight to keep the station alive. I'm really happy to see it's still going.
Yes, it has been touch and go a little bit in the last couple of years, but
yeah,
we've done it. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger, as they say.
Exactly.
Di, tell us, you've come back to Australia because of the pandemic, but let's just do a little bit of a recap on what you have been doing in the past. I think it's maybe 7 years working overseas in Africa and Southeast Asia. So give us a little recap.
Sure. So after Radio Adelaide, I worked at the university for a while managing the student union, and then got itchy feet again to head back overseas because I have a history of working in development. So I took a job as country director for the BBC's charity arm called BBC Media Action in South Sudan, and headed that up for 18 months during a real crisis period for South Sudan. So we were making programs every week about girls' education and maternal health and other, you know, things like that. And then I relocated with them to Cambodia, did some work there for a while, and then ended up with Fondation Hirondelle in Bangladesh on the border with Myanmar in the Rohingya refugee camp. So I spent about 14 months there producing refugee humanitarian information service radio. So every week the Rohingya would meet with us and go and, you know, develop stories that were relevant to the refugees in the camp. And so very practical information about health, sanitation, shelter, you know, preventing, you know, how to buckle down for a cyclone that's imminent, maternal health again, all that kind of content. And then now I've been based in Myanmar since January, working on human rights radio program and podcast there with a local team, which is great, getting stories from the regions all around Myanmar. Yeah, so I'm kind of doing a mixture of radio development stuff in radio, a bit of TV, a lot of online content, but yeah, a lot of radio now. It's all in local languages. Yeah, it's for a local audience. So yeah, it's a constant challenge of translation and getting material translated and being able to provide editorial support to people producing in other languages.
So presumably you're not in any way a broadcaster, you're making things happen and training and setting up infrastructure maybe. Say a little bit more about what sort of roles your job has been.
Yeah, so I'm very much in a managerial and leadership role. So I often interact with the donors, which are foreign aid donors, being country government, might be the Swiss government, might be the EU, might be the Dutch government. So I interact with the donor and convince them to hand over the cash and then make sure it's kind of administered, you know, on the project, do project management activities, planning, recruitment, and bringing in relevant people who can help support the project, which might be different trainers and support people. And yeah, dealing with all of that kind of overseeing of the project and answering day-to-day kind of any tricky editorial questions people might have. Navigating government approvals and things, which is much more complex in a humanitarian environment as well.
You must have to keep your wits around you in terms of sort of self-preservation too, I'm just thinking. You know, you've just told me South Sudan and Rohingya refugee camps for a start. Pretty demanding, possibly dangerous places to be in.
Definitely. And I've been commenting to people lately who are saying, oh, how are you coping with the lockdown here? And I'm like, well, this is really nothing. I've been in lockdowns before, actually, for conflict reasons, and this is a much easier and much more luxurious lockdown for me to put up with. And I'm very used now to isolation and being alone, and often where I'm working I get driven door to door from home to office, work all day, get driven back to the home, and then really can't leave or don't leave very much. So I'm used to being cooped up and watching a lot of the proverbial Netflix and chatting online with friends. So for me, this is pretty normal. I've learnt to tolerate that very well, I think. Some people are really struggling with lockdown, but yeah, for me, it's pretty normal now.
Yeah, well, I've been having a bit of a look at the places you've been and the kind of stories that come out of there. And one of the things that you said is that information is one of the key tools or key needs in that area of development aid. Do you want to say a bit more about that?
Yeah, We really consider information to be aid. So people think about aid and they think food, water, shelter. But actually, when you interview refugees in crisis situations and ask them what are their immediate needs, they will often put information in the top couple of needs that they have because they want to know what's going on, when can they leave, where can they get help, how do they access the resources within the environment that they're in. So information is a really critical thing, and I think the awareness of that has increased hugely in humanitarian circles. So we no longer have to try and explain that to people. I think there's now an understanding that you can't just keep people in the dark, and people need information. So that's really what we're focused on, is the idea that, you know, if you give people information, they're better empowered themselves to make decisions about their own life. And they're better empowered as citizens, you know, even if they're not in a humanitarian crisis, if they're dealing with other issues in their life. You know, most of the countries we work at are in some degree of poverty and often conflict. So, yeah, the more information they have that's accurate and factual, the better empowered they will be to take their own actions as citizens.
And us people in the Western democracies have just been getting a pretty interesting tutorial in that too, haven't we, with how lucky we are to get good information. You know, I'm just thinking of the stream of it that's been coming in Australia and how disastrous it can be to be getting misinformation, which is what's happening in the US. It's something that we may not have valued as much before. But
and misinformation is really rife in developing countries. In Myanmar, I know that very early on, they're very addicted to Facebook in Myanmar. It's almost their default operating platform is where they get their information from. So very early on, people were posting, you know, if you just drink ginger tea every day, then you won't get the virus. If you pray at the temple, you won't get a virus. In Africa, there's all kinds of cures around drinking black tea, putting pepper in your tea. I've even heard, you know, in some African countries, there's been an idea that if you spray chlorine on your body, then you won't get the virus. So there's a big role for the media to play in debunking those myths, which is what we do in a number of our programs that we make. Highlighting them, not mocking people for them, because in a lot of cases, they're very deeply held beliefs. I know in Myanmar, they flew a plane load of Buddhist monks over a temple to issue prayers over the temple to say Myanmar will not get the virus, you know, it will not happen here. People hold those beliefs very devoutly. So it's not so much a matter of saying, well, that won't help, but just saying, well, this is what we know can help. This is the evidence-based, you know, these are the things that you can be doing. But then also we've got to understand that we can't just issue information out to people, you know, with a blanket approach of, well, just practice social distancing, because a lot of countries can't do that. A lot of people are living in situations where there's no possibility of practicing social distancing. They're living in slum environments, they're living in crowded homes, etc. And we're certainly seeing that in places like Bangladesh, where there's now been hundreds and hundreds of police diagnosed with the virus. And they're because they are out there trying to actively police social distancing and quarantine environments, and now they themselves are sick. So very hard to give blanket information. You've got to tailor it directly to the context.
Di, how is it for you to come back into Australia?
To see the incredible privilege that we have here, that the idea that you would flout the rules and just go hang at Bondi Beach, it comes with a certain amount of privilege associated with that. What I've been seeing in places like Myanmar is daily wage workers who can't feed the family if they actually don't go to work. So for them, breaking the social distancing rule is a very reluctant one. They really don't want to do it, but they know that they have to. And we've interviewed bus drivers and roadside food stall workers and others who only get paid if they turn up to work, who are just saying, yeah, I want to stay at home, but I can't because I have to do this. So for us to have the privilege of staying at home, but then deciding, well, a game of golf is more important, you know, I find that quite difficult to take. Yeah, I think the other, you know, there's other big issues that other countries are facing that we aren't. Things like, we seem to really resent the idea that people have brought the virus in on planes, that, you know, Australians returning home from other countries, some of them have brought it back with them. But in a lot of countries, there are tens of thousands of migrant workers returning home and crossing the borders. In Thailand, they shut down all the factories. There's been about 30,000 migrant workers crossing the border back into their home country in Myanmar. You know, and they're facing discrimination and hostility from communities that they're returning to who are suspicious and fearful. And It's a much bigger problem, and you know, I think we need to practice a bit of common humanity in how we look at people who are returning back to their homes, whichever country we're in.
Maybe going back to the broader picture, not simply the pandemic, but what are the sort of go-to rules for what works and what doesn't in terms of, in particular, maybe the organisation that you're working with now? I know that you're working in Southeast Asia, but they also work in Africa, I think. What works?
Well, I think what we find is, you know, certainly working in local languages with local people, delivering news that's relevant to the context, and setting a high bar for ourselves in terms of independent journalistic standards, you know, really establishing that from the outset is what has differentiated the kind of work that we do in places like Central African Republic, Niger, Mali, where we've established radio stations or in some cases newsrooms that disseminate across multiple stations. So I think the accuracy and getting the trust of the audience has been really important for us. People know that they can tune in and get accurate information. And trying to find ways to reach the audience who in some cases are pretty hard to get to. So we've recently partnered with a telco that does an SMS service where in the Sahel, three different countries in Africa, people can just dial in or text a number and they will get the news to their phone from the radio station. They can just listen to it on their phone. That's getting over 7 million people a month contacting. So, you know, it's reaching out to communities that don't have access that's been, I think, important as well.
Keeping ahead of the technology and keeping absolutely matched to what's going on the ground is probably the biggest challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. We have, you know, pretty good track record in Africa. We're very well known, particularly in Francophone Africa. I find it interesting that in Asia, the community radio sector is far less developed, and that the governments of Southeast Asia in particular, but also places like Bangladesh, just not really tolerant of independent media voices. Whereas even in conflict-prone African countries, I certainly personally feel there is more space to actually deliver effective media at the moment.
Is it that the governments in Southeast Asia are more authoritarian or...?
Yeah, they are, and they're very controlling of information. And to a certain degree, you know, there's the influence of China in there, and they've learnt lessons from China about controlling information. I think some of it is, you know, just cultural. But yeah, there's a lot of people in authority clinging to power who see that as an important step. So in Cambodia, independent radio stations and newspapers have largely been shut down, for example. So if you live in the provinces, you will have only access to government radio now, which is obviously problematic. But having said that, there's some successes that we're seeing out of Asia. Myanmar and Cambodia are two examples of governments that have released their own economic response plan for the coronavirus, and they're delivering their own aid with their own money to the people in form of rice or oil or food. Cash payments. Myanmar has announced a 40% salary cover for factory workers who've been stood down. There's loans for small businesses. There's tax relief. The kind of complex economic response that developed countries are giving, we're also seeing from some developing nations. And I think that's a huge step forward. 20 years ago, that would have been unheard of.
Yes, like the pleasant surprise that we've had in this country and in other European ones in particular. How's India going, do you know?
Yeah, they're struggling in terms of the number of cases, but they also have been, you know, they've taken it upon themselves in the last 20 years to really step up in the form of kind of welfare systems and self-governance in terms of there's far less NGO activity in India than there was 20 years ago. They've really, the government has taken over a lot of those responsibilities. And yeah, there is certainly some aid flowing, but it's such a huge population. And with all of these countries, there will definitely be people falling through the cracks, not getting reached. Yeah.
Yes. So we might be beginning to look at the end of shutdown here, but globally it's just getting started. Is that the story?
I think the defining feature of many developing countries with coronavirus is that we will never know how many cases there were, even close, because the testing is just not happening to the degree that you would want. So in Myanmar, they're testing 200 to 400 people a day. This is a country of almost 60 million people. They would need to be testing many times more than that to get an accurate picture. So we don't really know, you know, how many cases there are. And I think Africa is quite an interesting one because in a lot of East African countries, Central African Republic, Congo, a bunch of others, they're all listing cases of around 100 or less. But if you go to the countries with bigger health systems and more testing, like South Africa, Egypt, Algeria, you're well into the thousands. So I think we can assume that the problem is much bigger than what is being spoken of.